I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's Mentally Yours from Ellen and Yvette. Focus on your mental health, you surely won't regret. It's mentally yours.
Welcome to Mentally Yours, Metro.co.uk's weekly podcast about all things mental health. My name's Ellen, and today we're talking to Lauren Brown. Lauren suffers from dermatillomania, which is essentially the name for compulsive skin picking. She's written a book all about it called Hands, An Anxious Mind Unpicked, out in January. We'll be talking with her about that today. I think we'll just dive straight in and just say, you've written a book about your mental health and specifically about skin picking. Can you talk to us about how that started for you? When did you begin picking? And then when did you realize that that had become a kind of a real life affecting issue?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. It's really lovely to be here. So it started, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. That's when it started kind of becoming a life affecting thing for me. I'd just left university and I'd moved straight to London. So I had my last exam on a Friday and I moved to London on the Monday. So it was very quick. And I moved in with, you know, it was classic spare room set up like with strangers. And I think at the time I was kind of in survival mode. You're thinking, you know, I want this to work. I want to make this work. You know, London's the kind of dream. So I think I was putting a lot of pressure on myself when really, as the weeks went by, I was feeling quite lonely. I was feeling quite isolated. And I think it was those kind of pressures that made me turn to skin picking. It's funny because it happened so gradually. I couldn't pinpoint an exact moment. Because it's one of those behaviours that you kind of do when you're a teenager, you know, like people pick their spots and you don't really think too much of it. And it was kind of a similar thing where it just started off as like, just, you know, you're out just picking your spots when they come up, to becoming more like focused and compulsive, I guess, where it would get to the point where I was picking when there wasn't anything there. I was just picking the skin, you know? So it's almost like it just went out of control, basically. And yeah, so about 3 years ago is when it got really, really bad.
So had you experienced kind of anxiety before, and did you have other, not coping mechanisms, but other ways of showing that you were experiencing anxiety?
Yeah, so like I've had anxiety and depression for pretty much as long as I can remember, really, or like since I was a teenager, certainly. But I've always just had like little weird quirks, or like it used to kind of escape in different ways, you know. And I think it was only on reflecting about my picking, because it's just one of those behaviours where you're like, where on earth has that come from? Like, never would I have predicted that this would become such an enormous part of my life. But it was kind of on reflecting about the picking that, like, all of these other kind of small behaviours that I didn't really necessarily think much of at the time started kind of taking on a new light, or I started realising, like, wait a minute, like, there's a bit of a trend through the years here. So, you know, I've always, for example, like, bitten my nails, like, right down to the quick, like, ever since I was little, like, I would do that. You know, I had this thing with my teeth where I'd, like, force myself to, like, press down on my teeth really hard, as if, like, I don't even know what that one was about, really. But just, like, little things like that where you just, like, you look back and you think, that is a very strange thing to do. But I think looking back, it's, like, almost like a self-soothing thing. I thought if I do it now, then it won't hurt later. Like, so I had issues with my teeth because I drank too much fizzy pop when I was little. And so, like, if I had, like, a sore tooth, I'd, like, press down really hard on it. So I'm like, if it hurts now, then I'll be ready for when it hurts later. You know what I mean? So I was almost, like, preempting, like, the eventuality that I was worried about. So lots of little things like that, which I go into in the book, where it's just this kind of maze of strange behaviours, which, like, all taken together, you're like, things start to make a bit more sense, you know?
So what prompted the kind of period where you went, okay, let me actually look into this a bit more, and made you kind of reflect back on what was happening?
So I was in, like I say, I was in London for that year. And during that time, I started having, like, therapy with this local charity. Like, I was really lucky. Like, I think somebody must have dropped out, because, you know, when you're told the waiting list is going to be so long, whereas actually I heard from them, like, within a couple of months. So I started seeing this really amazing therapist. And all of a sudden, one week when I was about to leave my session, I was like, do you mind if I just take 5 minutes just to calm down? Because down the little hallway, it was only in a little community centre, like this little rundown building, down the hallway from the room where I had the therapy, there's like a little toilet, just like an individual cubicle. And there was a little mirror, like really tattered little mirror, like you could barely see in it, it was so cloudy, above the toilet. And I'd started after the sessions, instead of going straight and getting my train, I'd like almost compulsively go into that little bathroom and just spend like 20 minutes just like looking in the mirror, picking at my face. And I was like, where's this come from? I hadn't recognized the behavior at home, even though I had been doing it at home. And I just thought, this is so weird. And I said to her, I was just like, I can't leave yet, because I know I'm going to go down the corridor and just lock myself in that bathroom for however long. Like, do you mind if I stay and calm down a bit? And I think that was the first time I realized, like, huh, like this has become this weird habit that like I'm using to kind of escape my emotions, or using to kind of zone out for a bit. Because I think the sessions had been so intense, obviously, like after the hour, it was almost like a way of just completely zoning out and like numbing out. And that's kind of what it became, essentially, like over the like ensuing months, I realized it was an issue.
How did the therapist respond? Did they kind of immediately go like, oh, that's dermatillomania?
Not necessarily. She didn't. I mean, it's funny because I'd kind of been Googling at this stage, like thinking, you know, typing in like skin picking, please, like how self-help or how to stop picking my skin. So I was already kind of familiar with the word, but I don't know if I was like in denial. I just thought, oh, well, it's not that bad. You know, it's not to that extent. So that word was kind of already in my, like, I don't know, I guess like background vocabulary, but I wasn't really thinking about it. But she, the therapist kind of said, yeah, I've noticed that, you know, as we've been talking, you've been like running your fingers along your face and your shoulders. And like, I'd very often have to like, you know, in therapy, like rooms, they often have like a really beautiful, like toy box full of fiddly things. Yeah. I'd always be like squeezing something or destroying something with my hands through the whole session. She was like, yeah, you do seem like a bit restless, which was probably a bit of an understatement, but she was very kind about it. And she just said, yeah, of course, like we can take 5 minutes to just calm down. And then like over the weeks, we started talking about it more explicitly, which kind of brought it home to me that like, all right, like this is actually a problem. I can't keep pretending that it's, you know, I'm in control and it's all fine. Like it was getting to the point where I was having to like leave my desk where I was working at the time to like go into the bathroom and like do it. You know, I'd be sitting at my desk and the urge would just take over and I'd have to go and just have a bathroom break and just sit in the work toilets doing it. So yeah, it was around that time really that I started realizing like something's a bit amiss here.
I think one thing that people who haven't had experience of kind of skin picking don't realize is how much of a compulsion it is. It's not really like, you're not really, you can be unaware that you're doing it, but you're definitely not choosing actively to do it. Can you talk a little bit more about what it feels like when you have that compulsion to pick and why it isn't just something that you can go, oh, I just won't do that, easy?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it almost feels like it straddles the line between like a compulsion and like an addiction, because for me, it's like, it gives you like a rush, like you get almost like a high from it, which like people are just like, how, like, I don't understand that whatsoever. You know, it's not like alcohol or drugs where there's some kind of like, you know, psychosomatic like chemistry going on. But I mean, I suppose there is, because it gives you a kind of rush of serotonin where it's, I know it sounds really awful and like, sorry to be graphic, but like when like a spot pops or whatever, it's almost like a rush of like adrenaline. And I think it was just giving me that like little high that I needed to kind of get through the day. So that's kind of an aspect of it. But also I think it's very much something that you get lost in. Like you'll start and just, you know, you don't tell yourself, oh, I'm going to go and do it for an hour. But you'll just say, oh, well, I've got the urge. I can feel it building up and building up, and I'm not going to be able to ignore it. So if I just do it once, I'll just get a bit of that tension out. Whereas obviously it doesn't end up being just once, and it ends up being, you know, for longer and longer. So it's just a kind of incremental thing. And I think that's what people don't really understand. It's like, you don't just go from not doing it to thinking, you know what, I'm a bit stressed today, and you know what, I think might help having a bit of a pick. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's not like that, because that just logically just doesn't track from A to B. But actually it's a very like slow burn, I guess. And yeah, it's just a way of kind of, yeah, self-soothing, I guess, a way of just like getting lost in an activity, and just kind of your thoughts going somewhere else, and you're just not fully present, if that makes sense.
So how have you found kind of, what's the treatment been for this? How have you managed to kind of get more in control of dermatillomania?
That is an ongoing process. So I had CBT over in lockdown, like at the start of lockdown, I had CBT. And honestly, like it's quite funny, some of the stuff you end up trying, because obviously it's a way of trying to give you like techniques, like arm you with techniques for when that urge hits, what are you going to do instead of just indulging it? Are there other ways of delaying that, of, you know, interrupting that cycle of thought and that kind of thing? So like some of them, it was actually like, because for me it's in the bathroom and in like the shower and stuff that it's really, really bad. So, you know, I've tried showering in the dark, which has had mixed results. I've, you know, showered with sunglasses on, which was not as stylish as you'd imagine.
I haven't heard that technique before, but yeah. I like it. That's quite smart.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite funky. I was like, you know, my poor boyfriend was having to kind of like, because part of it was him, you know, coming into the bathroom with me and stuff to help me, like to stop me doing it basically. And he must have just, what it must have been going through his head as he saw me like showering with sunglasses on. But just loads of different things like that, of basically just trying to like basically put like an obstacle in the way of the process, to just kind of like, if you can delay it even for a minute, you can almost like stop your mind tumbling into that place, you know, because you can feel yourself almost like slipping into it, and it's kind of snapping yourself out of it. So yeah, CBT is one of the main things, like cognitive behavioral therapy, which essentially just tries to give you techniques for dealing with the issue rather than going back, like other forms of therapy and like tracing it and stuff like that, like through memories and through like traumas and things like that. It just tries to deal with the behavior as it stands right now. But I think I almost ended up kind of slowly therapizing myself over the years of trying to understand like where it's come from. And I think that's kind of where the book has come from, really, of just like me trying to join all the dots together and work out where on earth this crazy behavior has come from.
Talk to us a bit about the book and what made you want to write it and put it out into the world.
Well, so it's kind of like two pronged, really. So part of it was, as part of my CBT, you're encouraged to keep like a diary, and like, you know, journaling can really help with all manner of mental health issues. Like, it's just a really like therapeutic, lovely thing to do, I think. So that was part of it. So I'd already started like writing down reflections and just thoughts that I was having about it. But obviously, I didn't think that, it didn't cross my mind that any of that like drivel would be publishable or in any way like a book. But so I'd kind of started writing about it. So I guess it kind of started there. But then there was this, I was made redundant in August of 2020. So like just in the middle of the pandemic, and I'd gone freelance for the first time. And, you know, I was looking around for different writing jobs and little things here and there that I might try. And there was one, and it was like, write about, it was like a competition in a magazine, and it was like, write about a memory of like a place that's really distinct, and for, of a really like, I'm not explaining this very well, it was like a place and a time that really stands out to you in your memory. So I wrote about I wrote this like 400 word thing about caravan parks in like the early 2000s, because that was like a huge part of my childhood and just like so much nostalgia. So I wrote that, and then all of a sudden like loads of other memories started coming out, and I just started writing them down. And then it kind of just ended up weaving into this like bigger narrative about my picking. And it, honestly, people are like, how did you write the book? Like, what was your thought process? It I feel like it just happened. Like, I feel like I just, writing for me is a way of entering that like third space that like my picking takes me to, where you're like, you let your subconscious come forward, and like your kind of worries and your anxiety all kind of gets pushed down, and you just enter this like third space. And I feel like writing is almost a way of like,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Of just like actually just letting your subconscious take control for a little bit and just see what happens. So yeah, that's a very badly explained, long-winded explanation, but it kind of was just loads of different things coming together, and it started to take this shape, and I just kind of kept going really. And this book popped out.
That was not a bad explanation at all. It also made me remember how much I used to love caravans and be really jealous of like,
oh my god,
families who I had caravans.
And they just like, my... me, they still remain like the height of luxury. I just think it's so so compact. When it's raining outside, you can hear the rain on the tin. Just like, what more could you want? A little fireplace, bit of Scrabble, beautiful.
100%. My grandparents used to have a caravan that they never took anywhere. It just lived in their back garden, and whenever I went out to visit, I would deliberately sleep there rather than in the bed, because I was like, oh, this is so cozy and cute. So yes, very much relate to that. it was a real treat. But back to non-caravan matters. So did you find writing the book therapeutic in a way? Was it a way for you to kind of process your own experiences?
Yeah, I think so. And I think what was really lovely about it for me, and I hope, you know, readers will find this as well, is that it's not all like doom and gloom in the way that when you're in your worst moments, you think it might be. Like, actually, when I was going through these memories, yeah, there's these kinds of signs of like anxiety and stuff like that. But oftentimes it's quite funny and it's quite, you know, joyful. And, you know, they're not all bad memories. It's all kind of tangled up together, you know. And it just gave me that, you know, that sense of, a lot of the times I'll find myself lamenting the fact that I'm in this position where I can't stop picking and it's just the worst thing, and you get feel kind of hopeless. But actually, when you take it together with all the rest of your experiences, and, you know, I wouldn't change anything, because it's the person I am now, you know. And it's quite cliche to say, but all of these crazy, strange behaviours and like even the picking has come to kind of form the person that I am today. And like, that's something to be celebrated, I think. It definitely did help me come to terms with the fact that, like, I don't need to be constantly trying to, like, necessarily escape these things. Obviously, I want to stop picking and I want to stop the compulsive behaviour, but it doesn't feel like the end of the world anymore, which felt quite huge for me.
Well, that I was going to ask, was there like a big kind of revelation that you had through the process of it? But I think that that's a fantastic revelation that, like, as like you say, it sounds cliche and corny, but like, that you're okay as you are, like, that's fine.
Like, when I was writing the book, and hope you can read this in the final chapter, where, you know, you're trying to come to an end, and I was really hoping, as I was writing it, I was like, I'm going to stop picking so that the final chapter can be this like great overcoming story. You know, no spoilers, but that kind of didn't happen. But I think the conclusion that I ended up coming to, like, for, with myself, within myself, and like within this the book too, is a bit more like nuanced and complex than that, but I think ultimately it's more meaningful and more rewarding, I hope, than that. So, you know, I think it is more complicated. And as I set out, I was really hoping from the beginning, right, I'm going to stop picking and that's going to be my kind of story of like overcoming. But life gets in the way of things like that.
Not to completely like spoil the ending of your book, and obviously anyone listening should absolutely buy it, but where are you now with skin picking? What's your relationship with it like?
It's still very much up and down. Like, I'm still struggling with it. You know, I'm way more aware of like my triggers and the things that kind of set me off, so I can offset them. But as with all recoveries, it's not linear. You know, I'll have good streaks of not doing it for a good few days, and then I have one really bad day or something will set me off. And, you know, but the gaps between the picking sessions, I suppose, are getting longer and longer. And I'm just kind of trying to focus on that, really, because, you know, it isn't as simple as just stopping, as beautiful and welcome as that would be. I would love it to be so simple. And you do have days where you think, oh my God, I've stopped. And I have these mini celebrations in my head where I'm like, I've did it. It's amazing. But then, you know, it happens again and you just have to keep overcoming every time. It's quite exhausting, to be honest. But, you know, that's recovery for you, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think it is important to celebrate those small wins, even as you say, like, it continues. It isn't as easy as just like one and done. But I do think it's important to go like recognize that, like you say, the space between the sessions is getting longer. That's
exactly
really impressive.
It's like, I feel like you can kind of put all of your hopes in this future event of like non-picking or not doing it. Like, ultimately, all you ever have is the present moment. And I think, you know, it's just appreciating the times when you're not doing it. And I'm getting better at that, you know, instead of just thinking, oh my God, you know, I had this amazing clean slate and I completely ruined it by having a little relapse. Actually, it's not as kind of simple as that.
I think one thing that's tricky about recovery from dermatillomania as well is that there's evidence of when you do relapse or when you do mess up, you know, and especially there can be a lot of shame involved around people seeing that evidence. How do you deal with that? And also, I think related to that, how do you deal with the fact that people are going to read this book and kind of have your worst bits exposed and readable for the masses?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because everyone keeps saying to me like, oh, it's so brave, or like, oh my God, I can't believe you're sharing stuff like that. But I think my whole point is like, the more people I talk to about it and the more people I hear from, like, we all have these like slightly quote unquote shameful behaviours that we wish we didn't have. And I feel like being a person is just like being a mess, you know?
Yes.
And it actually doesn't bother me like sharing it, because I feel like I know that I'm not alone in doing some of these things. Fair enough, like, my dermatillomania is quite an extreme example of kind of, you know, these behaviours taken to an absolute extreme. But it seems to me, you know, we've all got these things that we're embarrassed about. And actually, if we were just a bit more open about it with each other, one, we could have a laugh about it, because it is really weird being a person and trying to like be coherent. But also just like, you know, I've always been quite open about these things anyway. So I'm not super worried about people knowing about it. I mean, like you say, if they see me and I don't have any makeup on or whatever, it's kind of obvious. I mean, I do get kind of looks in the street, and a lot of the message boards online and stuff, especially in America, actually, people are saying, oh, people think I'm like a drug addict. Or, you know, like, people make assumptions because they see your skin and they think, oh my God, like, something's wrong with this person. Because it's not necessarily like, if you saw me, you wouldn't think, oh, that's acne, because it's mainly like scabs and like wounds. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, actual spots are there, because if there were spots there, I'd be at them straight away, you know? Yeah. So I think you can probably tell from looking at me when I don't have loads of makeup on that there is kind of something a bit up anyway. But I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not proud of it either, don't get me wrong, but I don't think the opposite of being proud is being ashamed. Like, it is what it is, you know? And I think just by accepting it and being open about it, hopefully other people can feel less ashamed or like feel less embarrassed, because that's the last thing you need when you're suffering from something like this. And you get it from yourself in your own head. You know, I mean, I have days where I'm thinking, I don't want to go to this party, or I don't want to go out because I've had a really, my skin's really bad. But, you know, I wear makeup and most of my friends know about it at the minute anyway and would never say anything negative in any case. So I think, yeah, I mean, the main way I deal with it, I suppose, is like I wear makeup. I like doing myself up like I always have done. But yeah, I mean, there are days like it does make you not want to leave the house when it's especially bad. But I've got like my friends and my family to kind of tell me to just put a bit of lipstick on and get out. But I think not keeping it to yourself and not holding it in is like, it's helped me.
Yeah. Like, and I think you're right. Speaking more about it will hopefully get to a point where I think, you know, what you said about some people thinking that people with dermatillomania, they're drug addicts or there's something really wrong. If we get more awareness out there, it might be that they go, oh, wait, that could be dermatillomania. Like they might actually be familiar with it, which would be really powerful.
And I also think for people not with dermatillomania, but, you know, skin not being perfect, I think it's just good to talk about these things. I think especially at the moment, we've got this kind of like clean eating, like clean, perfect skin. It's like the ideal thing to have, like perfect skin. But like everyone, skin isn't perfect like that, you know? And I think it's coming to terms with the fact that like skin has a texture. You're going to get blemishes every now and then. And just like, it's okay to just have like normal human skin and not the skin of like a beautiful porcelain doll.
Completely co-sign that message. It's fantastic. Sometimes I think about like, I don't know if you've ever been on like these Instagram accounts that are like celeb face and they like zoom in on celebrity skin. And it's just showing like, they do have pores,
isn't it?
It's completely obsessive, but it's fascinating. Yeah, it's
just like, you know, and that's what I'm kind of trying to come to terms with. Of just like, I think a lot of people who do suffer with dermatillomania, it's like a correcting thing. So they think, oh, there's a bump there. If I like pick it or correct it, I'll have smooth skin afterwards. And that's like a big motivation for a lot of people, I think, doing it. Whereas obviously that's counterproductive because it's obviously going to make more of a mark than the mark that was there. And I think ultimately like the way of overcoming that is just accepting that skin isn't meant to be completely flat or completely surfaceless. You know, it's a living organism.
Honestly,
it's an organ.
There's
like
so many things as well, because there's so much like pimple popping content now that I feel like people see a pore and they're like, oh, that's a blackhead, I'll squeeze it. It's like, no, that's just a normal pore.
So true. And this is my problem of like being a skin picker, because every pore is a goal, you know? It's just like you see every single pore of like, and things, I mean, it's so gross. So sorry to go into like the physical details, but like stuff comes out of your pores. Like even if it's not a spot, it's skin. So like you're going to get quote unquote like the reward of picking, if you see what I mean. So that it's like a never ending cycle. It's not just like, oh, I'm going to pick a spot. And like, I'm going to get the satisfaction of having picked that spot, because it gets to the point where you don't have enough spots to pick. So you just start going at your skin, you know? But
exactly that.
The
and
struggle.
You're eventually getting stuff out there that needs to stay in the skin. Like, I feel I have dermatillomania as well, but I'm also like very into skincare. And it's very interesting kind of marrying those up and recognizing like, do as I say. But like,
that's been another one of my like coping mechanisms, actually, where in trying to turn the destructive behavior into like caring behavior. So I'm the same with skincare. And I mean, it's been a bit of a rocky road because I've spent so much money that I don't have on like these potions that I've hoped will be like my great savior. But you know, they obviously never turn out to be. But it is nice to kind of try and turn that behavior into something that's like doing yourself some good.
Just being nice to yourself for a bit. It's nice.
And I hope that people, like, you know, dermatillomania, it's such like a specific condition. But I think all of us who are anxious have our ways of trying to get it out or trying to release that tension, you know, whether it's picking or something else. So I do hope that people can kind of relate to it, even if they don't suffer from like skin picking themselves. It's just, I guess, one iteration of how these anxiety gets itself out, basically.
So this is goodbye from mentally yours. So go away, enjoy your day, get on with all your chores. From mentally yours.
If you've been affected by any of the issues we've discussed today, you can give the Samaritans a ring on 116 123.
If you like Mentally Yours, you can also find us on Twitter. We're at MentallyYRS. We also have a lovely Facebook group, which is just called Mentally Yours.
And if you really liked us, you could do us a massive favour and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It's much appreciated. Helps us, you know, continue doing what we're doing. So please do rate and review and check back in next week for more Mentally Yours.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.